This is Matt Pennington with Red Air Free Asia. Welcome to South China Sea Currents, our weekly podcast on what's happening in the South China Sea. I'm joined by our South China Sea reporter, Drake Long, to talk about what he's been looking at this week in his reporting for Red Air Free Asia and Banar News. How are you doing, Drake?
Doing pretty well. Staying cool.
That's good. That's good. It is getting cooler these days. This week, Drake's turned his attention to a topic regarding the South China Sea that's all too often neglected, and that's the environment. Typically, governments, think tanks, and of course, us in the media, tend to focus on the military and security aspects in the South China Sea and overlook the fact that those disputed waters are home to some of the most remarkable marine biodiversity on Earth. I've just learned, for example, that there are 571 different species of coral in the South China Sea, compared to about just 70 in the Caribbean. That's right, isn't it, Drake?
Yep.
So what turned you on to this topic?
Well, the East-West Center was hosting a panel on science diplomacy in the South China Sea on Wednesday, September 30th. And I was intrigued by that because it looked like something a little bit non-traditional. Like you said, we focus a lot on the security aspect, but there's actually very little information out there about the environment, the ecology of the South China Sea. And this seemed like the right panel of seven scientists to go to speak on that. In the very first maybe 10 minutes of that panel, they started talking about just the sheer amount of biodiversity. Like you said, there's many species of coral reef, but they also let slip that there's 177,000 square miles of coral reef in the Spratly Islands, which is a figure I've never actually heard before. So I was hooked right from there.
Okay. So what was your takeaway from this think tank meeting?
Well, even though there is a lot of concern about coral reef destruction in the South China Sea, they actually sounded a fairly optimistic note about forming a multilateral mechanism called a regional fisheries management organization to try and conserve what's left in terms of fish stocks and coral reefs in the South China Sea. The scientists were optimistic, but I mean, the whole point of the panel was to kind of sound the alarm on how the continued militarization of the area and the lack of enforcement, lack of regulation is destroying the environment there. They were really trying to get together this non-governmental fisheries management organization, trying to appeal to scientists, conservationists, fishermen, and otherwise to come together and come up with a multinational solution to this. It was very interesting. I think it was a very good panel to listen to, especially nowadays.
So I understand that after the event, you had a follow-up interview with one professor who told you a little bit about his experience in the South China Sea and his studies. So who was that?
So that was Professor John McManus. He is a professor of marine biology at the University of Miami and the director of their Coral Reef Research Center there. He's actually one of only two people I've ever met who has been to the South China Sea physically, in person. He went there in 2015. He's been there a couple other times aside from that. And he's been looking at the area constantly since the 90s. So I had a very fascinating conversation with him about the science and the ecology of that area and what the stakes really are for preserving those coral reefs out there. Let's listen in.
What exactly are the costs of the tensions, the conflicts that we're seeing in the South China Sea? I mean, like I previously mentioned, there's an ecological monitoring station on Fiery Cross Reef, but it's on top of a reef that was destroyed to create a military base, which is a little bit contradictory. But with this base building, with the movement of maritime militia or just large-scale distant water fishing fleets into areas like the Union Banks, what kind of toll is that taking on the ecology of the Spratly Islands in particular, or in the South China Sea more broadly?
Yes, well, the issue of the coral reefs is quite important because this often happens when someone says, oh, the corals are dead, then people jump to the conclusion, oh, it's irrecoverable and therefore not worth worrying about. And somebody actually published in one of the Foreign Affairs magazine that the coral reefs are all basically destroyed anyway, so why are we worried about them? So we have to be very clear. Coral reefs do recover. For example, most of these coral reefs in the Spratly area are in waters that are hit by typhoons, typhoon being cyclonic storm, just basically the same thing as a hurricane. And so you get these fragile corals all across the reef flats, the waves are going to knock them over. And the more solid corals, the ones that are like boulders, those are actually, they have little crevices. So what happens in the case of the fragile corals is they grow pretty quickly. And the bigger corals, the tissue survives inside those crevices and then grows back out. We call it resheeting. So in both cases, we would expect a pretty good recovery within about 4 to 5 years and pretty full recovery within 10 years. So a conservative estimate is recovery within 10 years. So corals do grow back. It's like forests. We have trees that are thousands of years old. But that does not mean that you shouldn't bother planting it in the forest expecting something nice within 10 years. So that's a difficulty that people don't realize, that there is this recovery. However, there is a problem with the Spratlys, two problems. One is if you've built something, if you've put dirt, rubble, and pavement, in other words, you've paved paradise, you're not going to ever get it back. There's no way to recover that. So the parts that are covered now with these large structures, and most of the large structures are from China, so those are gone forever. But the ones that are damaged well over 100 square kilometers by the giant clam chopper boats, those dug up the bottom, and they're looking for giant clam shells. And the giant clam shells are being carved, and there's an international market for the products. It's they call it something like sea ivory. So it's a huge problem. And so most of the damage across the Paracels and Spratlys and Scarborough are all due to this. It took us years to figure out what's going on, because we see in the satellite image, you know, these arcs and this sand that's going everywhere. But it turns out that they're anchoring boats, you know, fairly small boats, and they have heavily reinforced brass propellers. I actually had to see one at the Philippine base before I understood. They run the motor and they push the boat back and forth, because no one in their right mind runs their propeller across a coral reef. There's a lot of places that are just like concrete, same material and everything. They're that hard. We thought, it couldn't be that, but indeed they can, because they have these very strong propellers, and they get so much money from the giant clams that they can afford to keep replacing propellers, motors, boats. They get, from two giant clam shells, they can get $1,000. That's just for the fissure. So it's highly economically profitable, you know, and very hard to stop. And the difficulty with the coral reefs is that tears up the substrate. So coral have to land, you know, they're sort of like little amoebas that are, you know, they change form and so forth. They come out of the water after some time, and they have to land on something hard, and they have to land on something stable so as the coral grows, it doesn't just flip over. So you have to have a hard substrate. In order to have a consistent hard substrate, you have to have a lot of corals start growing, knock over, get demolished, and then after a while it builds up this sort of crust of dead coral material, and that can support regrowth. So instead of saying 10 years for recovery from the giant clam cutter boats, we say 20 years. So most of the damage that's out there will recover within 20 years for places where they've stopped the damage. And we thought that China had actually stopped it. It was illegal to begin with in China and all the surrounding countries, but they seem to have started it up again. Well, they kept it going a little bit secretly in 2016, and by 2018 it was quite rampant.
Let me ask about cooperation, or at least enforcement, because it seems to be that, at least with the clam harvesting and the destruction, it's illegal in all these countries' territories, but it's still happening just because of a lack of enforcement or what have you. Is there enough enthusiasm within the conservationist or the scientific communities of China, Philippines, Vietnam, etc., to try to set up some type of management or conservationist regime in the South China Sea?
Well, it isn't easy. A large group of us have been working on this since early 90s. So the thing with the giant clams, this is one town in southern Hainan in southern China. Okay, this is Tianmen. And so it's not that widespread. It's just one town of that has a number of ships, and they load the ships up with these boats, and they go places. You know, there's hundreds of them, but still, it's all one big town. And that means it's got to be China that's got to do something about it. And it doesn't seem like they're likely to, because in with the pictures of these mother craft that are sitting near the reefs that are being damaged, there's usually Coast Guard from China watching it. So we know something is wrong here, but it's not the sort of thing that it's easy to go into China and say, well, you know, we've got to look into this. I'm sure that many government agencies in China don't like it, and most of them don't know what's really happening, and they don't know that the Coast Guard is actually part of it. So that's just a national problem. And of course, it's illegal on international scale as well. It's against the law of the sea to do this. We have no trouble putting together workshops. We just had one yesterday, a virtual workshop, but we've had workshops many times in Taiwan and Vietnam and the Philippines, and there have been some in Malaysia. You get the scientists together and they all talk about the situation. Sometimes recently we've also gotten Chinese scientists to some of these. That was one of the holdups, was China was not really participating very much. Yeah. At some point there was a law that basically made it a death penalty to say anything that hurt the country economically. So in the 90s that kind of shut up a lot of people. And that, you can imagine that would make you nervous. So there is that hesitancy. But lately, we actually did have a workshop in Beijing, and a series of workshops sort of sponsored by the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue out of Switzerland. And they've continued, and they've had one other meeting in person and another meeting virtually only a few months ago. So they are continuing that. And this is a big breakthrough. It, you know, it's got China, and China's participating. The one I went to, we had some enforcement personnel. We had good coral reef scientists. It was quite hopeful. The difficulty I had was, at that time, I thought, okay, we've already settled the giant clam issue, and let's move forward. And a week after I got back from Beijing is when my friends at CSIS explained that the giant clam stuff was going full force in Scarborough and in the Paracels. So that was very discouraging. We need a group of people who are meeting regularly, whose responsibility it is to keep track of things. And so that, around the world, that would be called a Regional Fisheries Management Organization, RFMO. And so there isn't really one for the South China Sea. There are FAO-related organizations like CFDEC, but it's Southeast Asian and it doesn't include China. There is no body that's actually looking out for the situation in the South China Sea. So that has got to be a high priority. We think that maybe it could happen, but it's going to be a real challenge. The big difficulty, of course, would be China. The second difficulty would be people's perception of what China could do, which is sometimes wrong. But they themselves will suffer as a nation quite a lot as these fish stocks collapse. So there's a strong incentive, and it's getting stronger over time, unfortunately, at the expense of many stocks of fish. There was a good study by the University of British Columbia using sort of a cutting-edge approach to get around the illegal, unreported, and unregulated catch issues. They actually use a lot of other indicators, like economic indicators and nutrition indicators, and we're reconstructing what the catch actually is. So this is really the best you're going to get without having research vessels. And they showed that somewhere around 20% of the fish stocks are estimated to be overexploited or already crashing. So we have to get this thing together. There has to be a fisheries management organization, more important there than anywhere else in the world. Up to 15% of the total world catch is coming from the South China Sea, and of course, very high diverse one. And the need for the income for that is as high as any place in the world. So we need to get a handle on this and come up with agreements on who's catching how much. We're always on the verge of fishery collapses on the shoreline, and we think that the reason they haven't collapsed is because fish are still coming in from the offshore reefs. So we have to protect those.
Well, that's really fascinating stuff. It's sort of more upbeat than I expected an interview to be regarding, you know, the state of the environment in the South China Sea. I mean, what do you, Drake, see as the prospects for greater cooperation among nations on conservation and fisheries management, given the rancor that there is in the South China Sea and all the territorial disputes and the rivalries there?
So going into the interview, I definitely thought that there was no hope because, I mean, just from my perspective, I see Chinese warships in the South China Sea all the time. I'm very familiar with the kind of issues there and how fishing kind of plays into politics, like at the regional level. But after talking with Professor McManus and going to that East-West Center panel and talking with a few other people, I'm actually more optimistic. McManus made the point that China does not have a fixed policy against participating in regional fishery management organizations. They do show up to workshops. There's a lot of Chinese scientists and academics that he works with who are concerned about the ecology of the South China Sea. And I mean, I think the most important point that he said in that whole interview was that, you know, China has an incentive here, an economic incentive, a humanitarian incentive to participate in these things. If the fishery stock in the South China Sea collapses, which it is on track to do, it'll affect China too. They'll be hurt just as much as any country, Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, what have you. And honestly, if you look at the numbers of fish harvested by country, China harvests the most. So actually, they may be the most affected. And I don't think China wants to have its fishing fleet get impacted that way. So there's actually a pretty strong incentive for them to come to the table and at least negotiate or figure out some transboundary, transnational, multinational regulation that would at least sustain the fish stocks for a couple more generations.
I guess it's a question of looking to the long-term benefit of conservation rather than the short-term gains that I guess all nations, not just China, but all nations on the South China Sea and you know, the large fishing communities making a living out of those waters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, Drake, that was a fascinating interview you had. So thank you very much for that. For those of you listening in, please check out Drake's previous articles on the South China Sea at rfa.org and banarnews.org. And hopefully we'll have a story, written story on conservation this week coming out on those websites. You can catch up on all our previous podcasts on those websites, and or alternatively, you can search on Spotify and iTunes for South China Sea Currents. If you've got any questions or feedback, please email us on South China Sea, that's all one word, at rfa.org. Or follow Drake on Twitter. His handle is DRM_Long. I'm Matt Pennington with Drake Long, the South China Sea reporter for Radio Free Asia and Banar News. This podcast series is created by Leo Kim and produced by Radio Free Asia. Thank you for listening, and please join us again.